Hello, you're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy Show, the view from my side of the cockpit door. I'm Captain Jeff, your host, broadcasting live from Studio 1711 at the Hyatt Regency Hotel in downtown Miami, Florida. On today's show, another laser attack, Boeing's long-term outlook for pilots and technicians, a United 757 plunges 20,000 feet from the sky over the Atlantic, a bunch of feedback from listeners like you, and much, much more. So get all settled in, sit back, and relax. Make sure your seat backs and tray tables are in their up and locked position, your seat belts are fastened, and your electronic devices are on, so you can listen to the show. Flight 36 is ready for pushback. Okay, great to have you with us again. Or great for me to be back with you. Hey, let me tell you something right off the bat here. I'm not sure if this sounds a little bit different or not, but it may. And the reason for that is I'm actually recording this using my iPhone. And of course, I'm not using the built-in internal microphone on the iPhone, although I could. I'm using a new app, and I'm part of the beta test program, but it's already out there in the App Store. You should get it. It's called Boss Jock Studio app. That's Boss Jock Studio app. I think it's only $4.99 in the iTunes store for your iOS device, your iPhone or your iPad. And it's fantastic. It actually is a full-blown podcast recording studio in the palm of your hand. And it has sound cards that you can play, like when I want to play feedback or my intro and outro and all that kind of stuff. It has automatic compression and limiting and gain control and ducking and all kinds of cool audio stuff. And I'm giving it a test run today. I am using my PR40, a very nice microphone, running through a mixer, but the output to the mixer is going into my iPod, or iPhone, actually, and I'm recording the show with this. So that's the reason why you're not going to hear a lot of those little jingles or bumpers or what do they call those things? Stingers in between little excerpts from the show and that kind of thing, because I have a limited amount of places to put my audio feedback. So we're just going to, and plus it's going to be another one of those long shows, so I have to get going here. So anyway, oh, darn it, Mark, keep adding those up. That beer is going to taste so good, isn't it? Let's get started with the show. You may have heard about this. This just happened 2 days ago at John F. Kennedy Airport, actually on approach to Kennedy. Let's take a listen.
JetBlue 657, check on with hotel 1-2000.
JetBlue 657, New York, good evening. Expect the ILS 22 left. You can descend, maintain 900,000.
Down to 900,000, expect 22 left. JetBlue 657.
JetBlue 657, altimeter 2996.
966.
JetBlue 657, turn right, heading 270 to 75,000.
Heading 270 down to 5,000, JetBlue 657. Center, JetBlue 657.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, sir, we just got lasered up here, two green flashes into the cockpit.
Oh, geez, all right.
It caught the first officer's eye.
JetBlue 657, thank you. You can descend, maintain 4,000.
4,000, JetBlue 657.
JetBlue 657, that was about 5,000 feet, right?
Yes, sir. 5,000 feet, two green flashes, and that caught the first officer in his eye.
American 1752, heavy turn left, heading 340.
340, American 1752.
American 141, heavy turn right, heading 270. Use caution, I just had an unauthorized laser illumination event about 7 miles ahead of you at 5,000 feet.
Okay, American 141, right to 270, then we heard the fire, thanks.
JetBlue 657, turn right, heading 330, and we are looking into the matter.
Okay, right to 330, JetBlue 657.
JetBlue 657, descend, maintain 3,000 at 3,000, reduce speed to 210.
Descend to 3,000 at 3,000, slow to 210, JetBlue 657.
JetBlue 657, turn left heading 280.
Left to 280, JetBlue 657.
Approach JetBlue 657.
JetBlue 657, go ahead, sir.
Can you have medical personnel meet the aircraft? We'll be at gate 24. The first officer is having vision problems.
JetBlue 657, you got it. Gate 24.
Thanks.
57.
Okay, well, you get the picture. This is serious, folks. More and more incidents involving folks playing with those green lasers and shooting them up to see if they can hit an airplane overhead. You know, it's nighttime. Our eyes are adjusted to the darkness. We have our night vision in full effect. And then all of a sudden, a very, very bright, high-energy laser beam illuminates the cockpit and apparently catches the first officer's eye here. And imagine if it had affected both pilots. In this case, it was just the first officer that was affected. But still, you can see how serious this whole thing is. So the industry and the pilots' unions and all kinds of groups are out there trying to figure out a way to fix this problem. And I hope that whoever flashed that laser beam up to the airplane gets caught and gets prosecuted, because, as I said, this is serious business, and it's just going to be a matter of time before we have an incident where passengers get injured or killed because of it. So just thought I'd play that for you. Now, last podcast, I mentioned that I kind of ran out of time toward the end, and I wanted to talk about something important from listener Dan Felton in the UK. And so let's get on with his letter, or his feedback. Okay, he writes, "Hi Jeff, hope is all is well. I wonder if your Nigerian friend managed to get some help from my Nigerian friend. I haven't heard back from Alkali yet." Okay, so to fill you in with some backstory here, you remember several episodes ago I talked about my friend in Nigeria, my Facebook friend, who was requesting help from me because he wants to become a professional airline pilot. He lives in, I think, Lagos, Nigeria. And I told him I could do whatever I could by mentioning his plight on the show. And if anybody out there knew of a way or knew something that could help Jeff, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name or his first name. I'm not sure how that all works, if it's his first name or his last name, but I'm just going to call him Jeff, and because that's what he calls himself, one of his names. So Dan wrote me shortly after that episode and said, "Hey, I know a guy, good friend of mine, and he's an airline pilot in Nigeria, of all places." And he said he gave me his contact information. And so we kind of paired these two up, and I just heard from Jeff a couple days ago, and he said that he's going to attempted to contact Dan's friend, and that I guess he was just leaving on a trip, but that he hoped to have contact with him in about a week or two. So I'll update you on the progress of that and see if that's going to help my friend with his dream of flying. Okay, so let me continue here. "Can I ask if I could get some support from you on an important issue? Below is a copy of a letter which I have sent to my local member of parliament, the locally elected member of government, which asks for his support on a serious threat to flight safety here in the UK. The UK Civil Aviation Authority, or the CAA, is signed up to a larger European body called the EASA, which is the European Aviation Safety Agency, and is obliged to adopt its rulings and findings, however good, bad, ugly, etc. They, Europe, are currently proposing to relax, yes, relax, the flight time limitations of pilots, which could mean that a pilot could find himself or him or herself performing a landing after a period of wake of 22 hours. Ludicrous, isn't it? I know that being in the U.S., you won't effectively have any say on this as a matter of UK Euro legislation, but I could use your show to raise awareness of this amongst the UK listeners and maybe even debate it, although I think you would agree that the debating on pilot fatigue has been done in years gone by to the point where we should have a good enough understanding of it to not try to push the limits. Fatigue is one of those insidious factors and needs to be regulated with an adequate safety margin built in. Perhaps you could forward my email to anyone you know in the UK and might be able to sign the online petition. Even just a brief debate on your show might be enough to get people to voice a concern. Take a look if you get a chance at the links I've provided in it, especially the video message. I would also like to hear your views on fatigue, and maybe you could dedicate some airline airtime to chat about it. Feel free to read out my letter, okay? And I'll just try to quickly hit the letter here that Dan sent to his parliamentary member, or member of parliament, Mr. Lefroy. It goes like this. Dear Mr. Lefroy, I'm writing you in order to bring to your attention and hopefully gain your support for a campaign to protect pilots and passengers from a dangerous relaxation to fundamental legislation, which, if implemented, will inevitably eventually lead to more incidents and accidents. This relaxation of pilots' flight time limitations is being introduced by Europe and would have to be adopted in the UK. A Transport Committee report into this can be accessed at the foot of this letter. We in the UK have been at the forefront of aviation safety, and through meticulous study of accidents and incidents, along with the help studies from the scientific community, we have learned bitter lessons about pilot fatigue and today have attained an exceptional record in air transport safety. It's still a fact today that around 70% of all aviation accidents are attributed to human error, and specifically flight crew error represents a high proportion of this. ICAO figures, I believe. Whilst flying remains the safest form of transport, it is still important to focus on the human component in order to continue to improve the figure where possible, as pilot fatigue remains an ever-present danger. As pilots, we are introduced to the concept of pilot fatigue and its sobering consequences at a very early stage in training. The European legislation would effectively erode the existing standards to a point where a pilot could find him, herself, landing an aircraft, having been continuously awake for 22 hours. Imagine that. I would not want to drive a car at this point, let alone be at the controls of an airplane. You'll be able to see that this invites disaster. You will probably appreciate that landing an aircraft, often in poor visibility and in congested and complex airspace, such as the southeast of England, demands a high level of alertness and attention, and this would be greatly depleted after such a long day. Throw into the mix having to deal with some technical complications with the aircraft, and you can see why pilots require protection enshrined in law, and right now we have this protection, and it appears to work well. Commercial pressures are obviously the driving force behind these changes, and I cannot see what else would lead us to want to drop our guard on an issue like this. These changes from Europe would have to be adopted by the UK via the Civil Aviation Authority. Airlines would then be entitled to roster crews on flights where these conditions would exist and be legal. It's not just the 22-hour case that's the concern, but the implications for cumulative fatigue to build up, as pilots could face a 7-day run of early starts. As I've said, there are many tragic lessons from the past, of which there are too many to list, and there have been much scientific study of human physiology and psychology to understand that this would be a step back in time. Okay, his letter goes on. I'll include his entire letter to Mr. Lefroy in the show notes. I'll have a link there. And in it, he also has some great links as well. And one of them is to the British Airline Pilots Association, who put out this little audio. Actually, it's a video, but it's mostly audio. It's just that the video just has a picture in it. And so I am going to play the BALPA, the British Airline Pilots Association effort to convince the people of the UK not to adopt this new relaxation of pilot fatigue.
A message from Britain's airline pilots. It seems like an obvious thing to say, but a tired pilot is a dangerous pilot. That's why there are rules that dictate just how long a pilot is allowed to fly before he or she is deemed unable to fly safely. The rules in the UK are very strict and have been developed over many years of study and scientific observation. Consequently, here in the UK, we have one of the best air safety records in the world. Unfortunately, that could all change if new EU rules regarding this issue come into force in 2012. On the face of it, applying one consistent set of rules throughout Europe would appear to make sense. In reality, the proposed rules would have our pilots flying dangerously tired. Independent scientific research shows us that the new rules would have our pilots landing aircraft in a state of fatigue tantamount to being four times over the legal blood alcohol limit for flying. Scary, isn't it? The airline industry, however, seems rather keen on the new proposals. The recession has put financial pressure on many airlines, understandably leading to their desire for increased staff productivity. They see the new rules as a way to achieve their productivity targets. A terribly misguided and potentially fatal mistake. Since the Colgan air crash in Buffalo, New York, a crash which killed 50 people and in which pilot fatigue was understood to be a cause, the Americans are tightening considerably the rules governing pilot flying hours. Europe can't be allowed to move in the opposite direction. We can't allow a fatal accident to be the spur that secures safe regulations for the UK and, indeed, the rest of Europe. There will be nearly 2 million flights in and out of the UK this year. As pilots, we want to make sure every single one of those flights is as safe as it can possibly be. Please help us to do that. Sign our petition on flight safety and pilot fatigue on the government e-petition website. You can access it via flightsafetypetition.co.uk. Then forward this video to everyone you know. And please remember, a tired pilot is a dangerous pilot.
Okay, Dan, I hope that that helps your effort to raise awareness of this proposed relaxation of rules over there. So let me know if you need any more help with that. Also, to my listeners in the United Kingdom, please see the link in the show notes to the online petition so that you can join in with Dan in trying to curb this new legislation. All righty. Chris Weitzel, or is it Weitzel? I always forget, Chris, sorry. From Connecticut sent this to me. He said, did you see this? It looks like a United Airlines 757 traveling from, let's see, where did it start? Somewhere in the United States, heading over to, Washington Dulles. Okay, there we go. It was United Flight 130 from Washington Dulles to London Heathrow, with 50 passengers and 9 crew, was en route at flight level 390 over the Atlantic Ocean, so 39,000 feet over the Atlantic, about 500 nautical miles east of St. John's in Canada, when the crew declared an emergency, reporting they had shut an engine down and they had descended to flight level 280 or 28,000 feet. The aircraft turned around and diverted to St. John's for a safe landing on St. John's Runway 29 about 130 minutes later. So a little over 2 hours later, they landed and everybody was safe and sound. Now, from our illustrious media, the headlines went something like this. United Airlines jet makes emergency landing after plunging 20,000 feet while halfway across the Atlantic. The plane dipped like a ferry in rough seas. The cabin crew ran down the aisles. Passengers jolted awake and watched the altitude drop on on-screen maps, forced to turn around mid-Atlantic and land in Canada. So, lots more of that. And it turns out that the airplane initially descended to a lower altitude. And the reason for that is, okay, there's an airplane up here, has two engines. And this is true with any airplane. Anytime you lose an engine, you have to descend to the appropriate altitude for a single engine operation, or if it's a multi-engine airplane, like a three or four engine airplane, for one engine inoperative flight. Because you're not going to be able to attain the or maintain your altitude with a loss of an engine. And it's not something that's dramatic or jolting. Now, when the engine had some trouble, it may have made some noise and it may have kind of rocked the airplane a little bit, but it's not like they were doing an emergency descent and everybody's hair was on fire as it was dropping out of the sky to 20,000 feet. On the contrary, it was a very, very controlled descent. And I thought that I'd had some commentary from this incident on the Aviation Herald website. Here's one, for instance. I heard this incident on the radio flying on a parallel track that night. This is from another pilot. The aircraft definitely did not fall or drop 6,000 meters, what you can read on some of the news sites. At first, they just descended from 39,000 feet to 29,000 feet, which is 10,000 feet or approximately 3,000 meters, and continued 50 nautical miles right of track. The descent took about 7 to 8 minutes, as I remember, so that's not more than about 1,500 feet per minute, which is a normal rate of descent in an airliner. They declared an emergency right away, and they gave position reports every 1 to 2 minutes stating their intentions. At first, they thought about diverting to lodges, but there was a kind of weather line they had to cross, so they turned around for St. John's and descended to 28,000 feet. They said their engine was still running, but not producing any power, and they didn't know what the cause was. So anyway, another example of our media completely blowing out of proportion what actually happened. It was just an engine failure. Now, that's uncommon because today's engines are pretty reliable, but the crew did exactly what they were trained to do. They did a nice engine out descent to the appropriate altitude. They were making the position reports that they were required to do, attaining assistance from other flights on the tracks that night, and they landed safely. So thanks, Chris, for pointing that out to me. Let's see, I was reading through some of the stuff I read, and Boeing has an article about their long-term outlook. It says that the demand for highly trained personnel as global economies expand and airlines take delivery of tens of thousands of new commercial jetliners over the next 20 years, the demand for personnel to fly and maintain those airplanes will be unprecedented. The 2012 Boeing Pilot and Technician Outlook projects a need for approximately 1 million new commercial airline pilots and maintenance technicians by 2031, which includes 460,000 new commercial airline pilots and 601,000 maintenance technicians. Meeting this demand will require airplane manufacturers and the commercial aviation industry to rely more heavily on new digital technology, including online and mobile computing, to meet the learning requirements of a new generation. The growing diversity of aviation personnel also demands highly qualified, motivated, and knowledgeable instructors with cross-cultural and cross-generational skills. Training programs will need to focus on enabling airplane operators to gain optimum advantage of the innovative features of the latest generation of airplanes, such as the 787 Dreamliner, which is built by Boeing. So there you have it. It looks like the Asia-Pacific region continues to present the largest projected growth in pilot demand, with a requirement for 185,600 new pilots. China has the largest demand within the region, with a need for 71,000 pilots. Europe will require a little over 100,000 pilots. North America, 69,000. Latin America, 42,000. And it goes on. So, interesting article about the need for pilots in the next couple decades. So, hey, if you're listening out there and you're thinking that you might want to have a career in the aviation industry, or in particular the airline industry, looks like right now is the time to jump in and join us in the pool. Come on, it's nice. It's nice and warm. Oh, and before I go any further, I have to thank my listener and fellow pilot, Brian Pottinger. He sends in feedback here and there, You'll remember that Brian is a Catholic mission pilot in Papua, Indonesia, and he mentioned a couple different times that he was going to send me some of that Indonesian coffee, and he did. So he said he was going to be in the States for a break, and when he was here, that he was going to send it to me. And so thank you, Brian. I did receive it, and it is incredibly good. Thank you so much. I wish I had some right now in my hotel room. I just have to settle for this nasty coffee that they put in the hotel rooms here. But I look forward to having another cup of the Papua New Indonesia coffee that you sent. Wonderful. Thank you very much. A nice gift. All right. Brian from Houston sent me some feedback. Let's listen to what Brian had to say.
Hello, Captain Jeff. This is Brian from Houston again. I just got back on a trip to San Francisco, and I had an interesting experience, or actually something I hadn't seen before, flying on United, and they have on their audio channel a section to listen to the pilot radio. So you can listen to the radio traffic as you're coming in and as you're following along, and it's just, I thought it was very interesting after hearing all the recordings that you do on this show to actually hear it while I'm flying on the plane that I'm actually on. So I just thought I would pass that along, that anybody's flying United to keep an eye out for that. I have one question for you. Recently, I think like 2 weeks ago, I think it was Frontier or Spirit Airlines had a had to divert to Houston for a unruly or disruptive passenger. And the once the passengers disembarked, they had to wait like 10 hours in the Houston airport in order to get another plane to Houston. Is that Well, my question is why couldn't they work with one of the airlines to turn around the plane that they were on, or is there some rule against that? Seems kind of odd to have to put your passengers have your passengers wait 10 hours so you can get another plane to the airport, since they don't normally fly into this airport. So if you could just comment on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for your feedback, Brian. And the flight was a Spirit Airlines flight 310, an Airbus 319-100, and it was en route from Los Angeles to Fort Lauderdale, and they were at 37,000 feet, about 40 nautical miles north of Houston, when the crew decided to divert to Houston's Intercontinental Airport due to a male passenger, 86 years old, who had become more and more disruptive and disobeyed crew instructions. The aircraft landed safely on Houston's runway 27 about 20 minutes later. The unruly passenger was taken into custody by police. The aircraft departed Houston after almost 15 hours on the ground and reached Fort Lauderdale as a different flight number with a delay of 15 hours and 45 minutes. The airline did not explain what caused the delay in Houston, but said they would fully refund all passengers. Police reported that the blind man, again, 86-year-old, spoke only French and had become increasingly frightened until he started to swing at other passengers. Okay, so apparently things were escalating and getting more out of control, and they decided to put the thing on the ground, which I think was a good decision. Going into Houston, I'm not so sure that was a great decision. I know they were pretty close to Houston, but I don't think Spirit has any kind of support or operation in Houston. There are a couple comments about this from people that seem to have a little bit of information about this. It said that Spirit's assistance to passengers was reported as horrid in local media. I guess this must be somebody from the Houston area. Their first plan was to bus them from Houston to Dallas-Fort Worth and put them on scheduled service out of there. And that's about a 5-hour bus ride. Although the airline's public relations statement says that refunds are being made. Some passengers have stated that they have been offered travel vouchers, not refunds. And here's another comment. After a near passenger riot, Spirit sent a plane to fly out of Dallas-Fort Worth. No doubt, at great expense. By the time they did this, they could have easily sent a relief crew in on another carrier to fly passengers out on the plane they already had there. True. Let's see. So apparently what happened was the crew must have run out of crew duty day after this diversion, I'm assuming. I don't know if there was a problem with the airplane or not. Here's another comment. Obviously, Spirit attempted to manage the event cheaply, busing passengers and other nonsense. It will cost them more in the end. If the disruption had escalated for a while, the divert should have been made to Dallas-Fort Worth. Not that much difference in flight time, and more reserve crew resources could have been made for a better outcome. And yeah, I agree with that. So apparently Spirit has some resources and support operations in at the Dallas-Fort Worth airport and not Houston. So looks like they may have bungled where they ended up landing and the way they ended up handling this. So that's the deal on that flight. I believe your, what was your question though? I forgot the first part of your question. Ah, darn it. Sorry, Brian. I don't want to go back and replay it. But the first part of your feedback, you had talked about United's very cool channel where you can monitor or listen to the radio communications of your flight and how they interact with their traffic control. I think that's pretty cool. I wish that ACME had that capability. I think for the most part, unless we say something embarrassing or do something wrong, and then I'd probably say, nah, I don't like that idea. But overall, I think that's a pretty neat thing that United has implemented, and they've been doing that for many years. So if you're flying on United, check it out when you're on the airplane. Look through there and see if you can find that special communications channel, and you'll get a little bit of a taste of you know, what we go through on a typical flight. Thanks again, Brian from Houston. Keep sending in your feedback. Saw this. New York Representative Gerald Nadler is introducing legislation that would require airlines to assign seats together to passengers who are related. Maybe it's Nadler, who is a member of the House's Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, said Thursday that the bill would prevent families from being separated because of airline fees for priority seats like aisles and windows. Air travel is complicated and expensive enough for families without adding new stresses, Nadler said in a statement. Families should not be stuck paying hidden fees or buying premium seats simply because they wish to be seated together on crowded flights. It is positively absurd to expect a 2 or 3 year old to sit unattended next to strangers on an airplane. It's up to air carriers to make their seating policies clear and easily accessible to the public. So he's dubbed this bill the Families Flying Together Act of 2012. And it would direct the Department of Transportation to enforce the family seating requirement. I think it's a good idea, actually. I know that, you know, airlines are trying to, you know, eke out every last dollar out of the passengers out there. And knowing that someone might be willing to pay a little bit more for an aisle seat or a window seat and not get stuck in that dreaded middle seat. You know, if it's a family, I agree. Let them sit together. You know, there's enough stress when flying. So good for you, Representative Nadler, and I'll keep you up to date on how that goes. This from one of my listeners, Mariana. And it's not from Mariana's iPod. This time it's from Mariana's computer. Dear Captain Jeff, seems that about once a week there is, quote, breaking news about turbulence during flight or other incidents involving commercial flights. Now, it may be that I'm just noticing it more since becoming a fan of the airline pilot guy, and some of these incidents are truly newsworthy, but I'm beginning to think that it's becoming like reporting bad weather. There aren't enough adjectives left for reporters to describe either. And they are beginning to sound like Chicken Little. The sky is falling. Well, in these cases, the planes I've flown several times, Well, in these cases, the planes. Oh, okay, I see. I'm sorry, I misread your sentence there, Mariana. Let me start over. And they're beginning to sound like Chicken Little. The sky is falling. Well, in these cases, the planes. I've flown several times and can't recall a flight that wasn't at least a little bit of a bumpy ride. Do you think the number of incidents of severe turbulence and other incidents have significantly increased? Or is the 24-hour, 7-days-a-week media just reporting, hyping more of them? Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Mariana. Well, Mariana, I don't think that these incidents are occurring anymore. In fact, I would guess that they're probably occurring less often because I think there's more awareness out there of the hazards of turbulence and thunderstorms, which is usually the weather factor that's involved with creating the severe turbulence episodes. I also know that air traffic control is required now to because they have weather radar overlays on their screens, and that they are required to point out to pilots when we are going to be approaching areas of moderate to extreme rain showers and that kind of thing. So that was something that they weren't required to do several years ago, and now they are. So I think there's more awareness of hazardous weather now. I think that you hit it. I think it's just the 24/7 news cycle that we live with today, and they have to report on something. So I think it's just being reported more, and I don't think that it's happening anymore. So that's just my 2 cents. So what do you think? If you want to send me feedback and let me know what you think about any of these stories, or if you have a question about something else, send it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or you can go to my Airline Pilot Guy website, click on that little tab on the right that says send voicemail, and it'll use your computer's microphone, and you can record a message, and it will send it to my computer, and I'll play it on the show. Or you can call up 304-99-PILOT, my voice feedback line, and leave me some voice feedback that way. Okay, the next one, I tried to get it in on the last episode, but I ran out of time. And this is from Sebastian from Germany. Hi, Jeff. It's me again, Sebastian from Germany. I've fallen a little bit behind on listening to your show, but I'm catching up. Just yesterday, I was listening to your show 32. Once again, a really good show. Thanks, Sebastian. Before I get started on commenting on the first feedback from China, I would like to ask you something about the L-1011. I don't really know someone who did fly the L-1011, but I've heard a lot about it, especially that it was well ahead of its time. Now, the question I have is that I keep hearing that the TriStar actually was the first fly-by-wire airplane ever built. I know it was not a fly-by-wire as the Airbuses are, but apparently there must have been some sort of fly-by-wire technology introduced. Is that true? And if so, how was it integrated? And so, I did fly the L-1011 as a first officer for 3 years, and I can tell you for sure that the conventional controls were not fly-by-wire in the sense of fly-by-wire we use today. They were, cables that connected to hydraulically actuated control surfaces, etc. But I can tell you that there were a lot of advanced systems on the L-1011, and one of those, which I guess you could kind of consider a fly-by-wire system, was a system installed on the Dash 500 version of the TriStar, and it was called the Active Control System. And let me read a little bit from the, let's see, where was this website? It's something like the TriStar, I forgot exactly what the name of the website is, but anyway, found this online. The Active Control System, the TriStar 500 is known as being a very stable aircraft even in rough turbulence. The Active Control System contributes to this increased stability. While Douglas was studying and testing winglets in its DC-10 aircraft, which were eventually introduced on the MD-11, Lockheed believed that a more efficient way of reducing induced drag for better fuel economy was to increase the TriStar's wingspan, giving a higher aspect ratio to the wing. However, increasing the wingspan usually requires wing reinforcement and thus higher aircraft weight. The solution found was to design an active system which would work for wing load alleviation. The principle of operation of the ACS is very simple. Accelerometers were installed in the fuselage and the wingtips of the L-1011, and they detect vertical accelerations induced by turbulence or flight maneuvers. The system uses this information from the accelerometers to symmetrically deflect the outboard ailerons in order to redistribute lift forces across the wingspan and to reduce wing bending. And they have some pictures in this article. The amount of deflection of the ailerons functions as airspeed changes. The active control system actuation is 100% automatic. It benefits fuel consumption and gives the L-1011-500 the smoothest ride of all commercial aircraft. So, they had this system, the active control system, that worked in a way that was completely autonomous. It was happening out there without any input from the pilot crew, 100% automatic. So in this way, it's using the flight control system in a way to make for a smoother ride and reduce stresses on the wings. And so I guess you could call this the first implementation of a fly-by-wire flight control system. Let's see, what else? And I may have mentioned this on a previous podcast. I'll tell you what, you know, as I said, I flew the L-1011. It was the most comfortable airplane I've ever flown in my life. It's the most beautiful hand-flying airplane that I've ever flown. You wouldn't think something that big would be as nimble and just a joy to fly, hand-flying, but that L-1011 was, and it was fast. We were routinely traveling at 0.86, 0.88 Mach, whereas most airplanes these days travel anywhere from about 0.75 to about 0.80. That's the normal Mach speed that most airliners are flying out there. Now, some of the newer ones, like the 777, I think they're up there around 8.5, 8.6 as well. But the L-1011 was a beautiful airplane, and we would hear people complaining about turbulence left and right, and we'd be just flying along fat, dumb, and happy. And another reason why this was is that it had a system on it called the Performance Management System. And it's another system particular to the L-1011, which is incorporated into the flight management system. Lockheed noticed that the optimum cruise Mach was unstable, and it resulted in a lot of throttle movement and throttle corrections. In other aircraft, many airlines would opt for a higher Mach number, which also led to a higher fuel burn. The performance management system was designed to keep airspeed precisely by changing with small variations the aircraft's attitude. Actually, it means to say the aircraft's altitude. If the airspeed is above the selected figure, a nose-up command is sent to the horizontal stabilizer, making the aircraft rise a maximum of 50 feet and lose speed. And then conversely, if the airspeed fell below a selected figure, a nose-down command is sent, and the L-1011 descends a maximum of 50 feet to gain speed without throttle movement. The benefits from this system were better fuel efficiency, extended engine life, and less auditory fatigue for the passengers due to thrust variations. And I would say also, Jeff speaking here, that it also helped smooth out and give us a much better ride. Okay, so Sebastian from Germany continues. Now to my comment on the China feedback. First of all, I would like to say state that Joseph from China was wrong when he was speaking of metric flight levels in Germany and Russia. Now, ever since the Second World War ended, Germany has been using the U.S. standard flight levels, meaning they're using feet. That is also true for all of Europe, including Eastern Europe. And just recently, I think it was April 1st of this year, Russia has dropped its metric flight level system in favor of the U.S. standard flight level system. One restriction, this is only true for the levels above transition, which in Russia is 600 meters or roughly 1,800 feet. Below that altitude, they still use meters based on QFE, which really is quite strange for us. By the way, speaking of transition altitude, I know the U.S. uses 18,000 feet, but all of Western Europe uses 5,000 feet for the transition. Now, for those of you out there who are not pilots, you're probably wondering what he is talking about here as far as transition altitude. In the United States, when you're passing through 18,000 feet, we dial in a altimeter setting, 2992, which is a standard day pressure, 29.92 inches of mercury. So all the airplanes like the business jets and the airliners above 18,000 feet in the what is it called, the Class A airspeed, airspace, we used to call it positive space. What do we call it? Positive airspace, positive control area, PCA, something like that. I think now it's called Class A. So everybody is using the same altimeter setting because you know that weather is caused by differential in pressures. So on the surface, the reason why we have all these low pressure systems and high pressure systems, et cetera, or the reason why we have weather is because of these high pressure systems, low pressure systems. And so when you're approaching the ground, you want to make sure that the altimeter that you're using, the thing that tells you how high above the ground you are, is set to the current pressure reading for the place that you're flying over, obviously, because if it's incorrectly set, you could possibly hit the ground. So we need to know exactly how high we are above the ground in that area. But once you get, you know, quite a ways above the ground, in this case in the United States, 18,000 feet, there's no need for us to continually be changing our altimeter settings on our altimeters. So we've set in a standard, what we call the standard datum plane, which is 29.92 inches of mercury. In other countries, as Sebastian mentions, like all of Europe, they use 5,000 feet. So when they're climbing out, pretty quickly after they take off, they're setting that 29.92 setting in their altimeters. And when they're descending, they keep that in there, and they're using flight levels until they get, you know, much, much closer to the ground than we do in the United States. Okay, so the second thing, this is back to Sebastian's feedback. I would like to comment on Joseph mentioning air traffic control and language difficulties. It is true that English is the number one air traffic control language used worldwide, but it is not the only official International Civil Aviation Organization language, or I like to say ICAO. French, Spanish, Russian, and Chinese are also official ICAO languages and are being used quite a lot. Me, being a short-haul 737 pilot based out of Germany, I definitely know what I'm talking about. Flying to France, I sometimes am the only pilot using English with ATC, since the French are especially proud of their language, at least so it seems. Also flying into St. Petersburg, which I will again on Sunday, or Moscow, it's really hard sometimes. Now, from my point of view, doing so is absolutely not safe at all, since you, as a pilot, completely lose the situational awareness. My worst experience concerning this was some months ago flying into Paris, Charles de Gaulle, Category 3 weather conditions. We were just clear of the sensitive area waiting behind an Air France Airbus 320 when the ground controller asked us to taxi behind and follow the preceding Air France, to whom he had issued the taxi instructions in French. So we were to follow an airplane at minimum visibility, not knowing where we were going. Of course, we rejected that clearance and asked for it to be repeated in English. But even if everyone speaks English, it sometimes can be quite interesting. That's not only because of language problems, but also due to some pilots not using standard ATC phraseology. Concerning language problems, I know from a friend who is an ATC controller at one of Europe's largest airports that most Chinese and Russian airlines get a special separation flying into or out of the larger airports because they just do not understand English quite as well as they should. Now, when it comes to poor ATC phraseology, it's not the Chinese and the Russians who are the worst, but the major U.S. airlines flying to and from Europe. I know that might come as a shock, since English is their native language, but still, you have to obey the ATC rules. Ah, my telephone's ringing. Hang on. I'm going to put this on pause. Okay, I'm back. That was probably my co-pilot, first officer, calling to see if I want to get a bite to eat for dinner, and I'm not going to do it. I'm going to sacrifice my hungry tummy to continue recording this podcast for you, my beloved listeners. Okay, and then after this, I'm going to go out and get something to eat. Let's see, where was I? Okay. Now, when it comes to poor ATC phraseology, it's not the Chinese or the Russians who are worst, but the major U.S. airlines. I know that might come as a shock, since English is the native language to the U.S. airlines, but still you have to obey the ATC rules, and that is accurately read back any instruction and use standard phraseology. It is of utmost importance to do so, because that's the only way everyone knows you understood the message and you are also going to comply with it. I quite often hear clearances by ATC like, turn left heading 240, descend 5000 QNH 1020. Remember, we use hectopascals in Europe, not inches of mercury. And the readback is simply, Roger that. Now, this is not the standard. Also, it is call sign, blah, 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 cleared for takeoff runway so-and-so, and not, we're good to go. What I'm trying to say is, please, everyone out there, no matter if English is your native or second or third language, we all share the same sky. He's persistent, isn't he? Hang on. Okay, I guess I'm going to have to do some editing here. Oh, I was hoping I wouldn't have to. Oh, well. Let's see if I can get back to where we were supposed to be here. What I'm trying to say is that, please, everyone out there, no matter if English is your native or second or third language, we all share the same sky and we all work together. So, let's please try to be as accurate as possible when it comes to ATC phraseology. It really does help to keep us all safe. I know it does not sound cool, but still, it's the standard, and ATC should never be a puzzle to everyone else on the frequency. Sorry, Jeff, for getting carried away, but I really had to comment on that. Now, thank you once again for a great show. As always, keep the blue side up, lots of tailwinds during cruise, and God bless, Sebastian. Thank you, Sebastian, and I couldn't agree with you more. I often hear, even in the States, guys saying, you know, like, air traffic control tower clears us for takeoff, or clears them for takeoff, and they say rolling, or, you know, here we go, or whatever, instead of using the proper phraseology. And it is important to use, especially when you're flying in different areas of the world, it's even more important that you use the proper radio discipline and radio phraseology. I definitely agree with you, Sebastian. And I do have a little bit of experience with instructions read and readbacks in a language other than English, like when we fly into Quebec, and they're speaking a lot of times in French, and I don't understand French, and so it takes me out of the situational awareness that I like to have. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very concerned about this idea that in the future we're not even going to use verbal communications to receive and issue instructions, but it's all going to be digital. So it's going to be like text messaging. So if they want ACME flight 403 to descend and maintain 20,000 feet, or flight level 200, it'll be via a digital message and not a voice message. And a lot of you will say, well, what's the problem with that? You know, you have like a digital display of text and there's no misunderstanding it. Well, the problem with it is that when I'm listening to a frequency with other airplanes on it, I'm building in my head the spatial arrangement. I can using my mind and listening to people talking about where they are and what altitude they're descending to, I'm building this map, this three-dimensional map in my head, and I know where people are, and I can hear what they're experiencing, if they're experiencing turbulence or whatever. You take the verbal communications out of it, and I think you really affect safely to its detriment. And now I'm all for having both verbal and as a backup or as an additional feature, the data sent via text to our digital displays in the airplane, but not instead of. So, and this is a case where you're hearing air traffic control giving instructions to other flights around you in a different language that you don't understand, and they're reading back instructions that you don't understand, and you're basically taking them, you're just getting taken out of the loop completely. So I don't like it either, Sebastian. So good point made, and I don't know what we're going to do about it, but I guess just to be as vigilant as we can and try to change it if we can. So if you have any ideas about that, or if you agree or disagree, send me some feedback. Thanks again, Sebastian. Okay, let's see. A shocked congregation in the United Kingdom at Brentwood Cathedral in Essex were undertaking the Eucharistic prayer when they heard this. Or something like that. They heard a massive explosion, which left them trembling. Father James McKay, who was leading the Sunday service, described seeing slate and white ice falling from the roof, damaging the structure and beams. An usher who inspected the damage believed it had been caused by a block of ice falling from above, which could have come from an airplane, he said. A spokesman for the Civil Aviation Authority confirmed the body received about 30 reports of ice blocks dropping from aircraft in a year, but said they were frequently caused by natural weather conditions. Father McKay told the BBC he was trembling with shock after hearing the collision, but had continued with the service. So, looks like a block of ice must have formed on the outside of the airplane and got so big that it just broke free from the airplane and landed through the roof of this the Brentwood Cathedral in Essex. Boy, I tell you what, that would definitely get your attention, wouldn't it? Luckily, nobody was hurt. And now, I have some feedback from my friend Mark Labrowski, who I'm going to owe some Labrowski because I keep saying anyway. So here we go.
Hi, Captain Jeff. Mark here from beautiful Lake Norman, North Carolina, with a multi-part question on the ever-so-engaging subject of weight and balance. Now, do you guys and gals flying the heavy iron do weight and balance calculations for your flights yourselves? Or is there some number-crunching bot in a back room somewhere that chews the raw data and spits out the information you need? Did you ever have to actually rearrange passengers or cargo so as not to exceed some operational limit? Does ACME use some sort of average weight per flying passenger calculation to come up with the data? If a sumo wrestling team comes aboard, do they have to be strategically placed about the cabin to avoid busting aft CG limits? Curious minds need to know, Captain Jeff. Thanks for the great work.
Thank you, Mark, for sending that feedback. And yes, it's some kind of a autonomous... Oh my gosh. Okay, hang on. Okay, I'm back. Pardon the interruption. Let's see. Yes, regarding your question, Mark, about the weight and balance data, and is there some backroom bot that does all these mindless calculations? And, well, sort of in a way. Well, it depends on the airline. I do know that a lot of the pilots that I fly with who came from regional airlines tell me that it was kind of their job as first officer to make the calculations for, you know, bringing in all this information like the fuel load, passenger loading, cargo loading, et cetera, the flight duration and other all these different things that go together to calculate the proper weight and balance data that is important to know, because you want to operate the airplane within the limits of the center of gravity and the mean aerodynamic chord and all kinds of center of lift and all these different things. So you want to make sure that throughout the entire flight that the balance of the airplane stays within a safe area with safety margins. And you obviously need to know, well, may not be obvious to you if you aren't a pilot, but it's very important that we know how heavy the airplane is, because those wings have to produce a certain amount of lift. And if you are heavy, they need to produce more lift to lift you up. And that means you have to go faster to get the relative wind over the wings high enough to produce enough lift to lift whatever it is you're going to lift up off the ground. And so we have to make sure that we are using the proper weights and everything is loaded properly to keep everything safe. At ACME and other large airlines, that function is taken care of by other departments. And at ACME, we have something called the Load Control Center, and they provide payload and fuel distribution services and produce the final departure documents for all ACME flights. And they resolve weight and balance issues to ensure regulatory compliance, optimize payload, and maintain on-time integrity. So they, you know, take the fuel load and the passenger load and the weather conditions and maintenance items and such, and they put it all together, and they end up giving us all the data that we need to have to operate the aircraft safely. And the way it's normally distributed to us is via the ACARS system. And you've heard me talk about ACARS before, and that's the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System, which is a digital data link system for the transmission of short, relatively simple messages between the aircraft and ground stations via radio or satellite. And so that's the way we end up receiving information from our load control center. So right before we push back from the gate, or sometimes a little bit after we push back from the gate, but optimally, it arrives before we push back from the gate. And we print it out on the built-in printer in the airplane. And we have all the numbers for the different air runways, different power settings, flap settings, center of gravity settings for the stabilizer, et cetera, and the speeds that we need to fly for, you know, when to rotate the airplane, et cetera. So that's the way we do it at ACME. And it was a great question. Oh, by the way, I do seem to recall that there is a standard weight that they use for each passenger and his or her bag or bags. And I believe it's like 200 pounds during the summertime. And I think they actually increase that figure, maybe. I'm not sure about this. But I think that's increased in the wintertime to allow for, you know, more clothing and coats and that kind of thing. And to your question about, you know, if there's a whole, like a, what do you call that, a charter flight of sumo wrestlers, obviously their average weight is much, much higher than your typical human person. And so they do account for the increased weight for, let's say we do these charters for football teams and that kind of thing. Well, those guys are big. They're heavy. Military charters, they use a higher figure per passenger because they have a lot of gear with them. You know, their duffel bags full of really, really heavy stuff and backpacks and such. Let's see, what is another example? If a flight has is getting close to its limit as far as the maximum weight for takeoff or maximum weight for landing or whatever, and it's, they know for a fact that there are many children on the flight, they can elect to use child weights. and that reduces the weight figure per passenger to ensure that you get as many people on the airplane as possible and still be within the legal limits of operation. So that's one of those things for pilots that we, when we hear that they have been using child weights in calculating all of our weight and balance data, that's kind of a red flag. Like, ooh, okay. In other words, we're really, really close to our weight limit, and we have to be very careful to ensure that everything is above board and safe. So thanks for your question, Mark, and keep listening for my anyways. And next time I'm in North Carolina, I guess we're going to have to meet up, and I'll have to buy you a beer or two. Okay, let me put this on pause for a second. Jen from Northern California sent me this voice feedback.
Hey, Captain Jeff. It's Jen, the Lutheran pastor's wife, calling to give you the feedback you requested regarding the JetBlue pilot and the lawsuit. I don't think that it was negligence on the part of JetBlue to allow him to fly. If they'd known that he was going to have a psychotic break or whatever happened that caused him to be running around the plane screaming about Al-Qaeda and Jesus, that would be one thing, but they didn't. And when it happened, he wasn't allowed back in the cockpit, so I really can't see how any judge could entertain a claim of negligence on their part. If you're going to talk negligence, I'd say that the situation of the Danish pilot flying from Afghanistan to Turkey, letting him back in the cockpit after having a seizure, that would be negligence, because he's demonstrated that he's not fit to be at the controls at that point in time, and I just can't see that that was a good plan by any stretch of the imagination, especially if the seizure had reoccurred. I have watched my son Daniel have seizures, and you're pretty out of it afterwards. I know from having watched him, he's been. So I honestly think that I would not have felt safe on that flight, knowing, you know, what I know, having heard all of that. So my vote on the first one is not negligent. With the Danish airline, yeah, definitely negligence. The guy definitely should not have been allowed back in the cockpit. Thanks. God bless. Love the show as always. Bye-bye.
Well, thanks, Jen, and appreciate your feedback as always. And I agree with you. My vote is not negligence in the first case, and negligence, at least by the crew, in the second case for allowing the Danish captain to return to the cockpit and flight duties. Speaking of the JetBlue in-flight meltdown, Osben, I think is his name, I saw this, it was an ABC News report. The JetBlue airline pilot, who went on a frightening in-flight tirade in March, forcing the flight to be diverted, was having a, quote, brief psychotic disorder because of sleep deprivation, a psychologist testified at a hearing. The psychologist's testimony given last week was revealed in court documents released today. According to witnesses, Clayton was, we know about what happened there. Let's see, I wanted to get to the part that I thought was ridiculous. Despite denials from the airline industry, ABC News has found that large numbers of pilots have reported for duty every day after getting only a few hours of what fatigue experts call destructive sleep in crowded crew lounges and so-called crash pads. Critics say that widespread pilot fatigue is putting airline passengers at risk and may already have cost lives. Well, that is true. But, you know, there are a lot of us who end up, you know, flying, like this trip, for instance, pretty early Well, not this trip that I'm on, but I do fly a lot of trips where I have to get up at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning because the report time in the morning is so early. And you know what? Sometimes you just don't get the best night's sleep. You know, it interrupts your circadian rhythm, that especially between the hours of 2 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Those are the two critical periods. And when you're having to wake up between 2 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning, It does impair your ability, but I don't think that there are too many instances of guys going berserk out there like this Clayton Osmond guy did. I think that's a bit far-fetched. I don't think you can blame this on lack of sleep or fatigue. I mean, that's just me personally. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist, but I have enough common sense to know that this is a bunch of BS. Thanks again, Jen, for your feedback. And let's move on with some more feedback from the guy with a great name, Chess Griffin, sent me this. BAE Systems speaks about the unmanned Astraea? I'm not sure how you pronounce this. Astraea. Their Astraea isn't a new concept. It's the company's been playing up its unmanned potential for quite some time now, but it's all seeming entirely less pie in the sky now that the Farnborough Air Show has kicked off. Typically, UAVs are thought to be smaller drone-type apparatuses. These things are typically used in military exercises where remote gunfire or reconnaissance is required. Clearly, it's about time someone asked the obvious. Why? So basically they're pushing for this, it looks like a Jetstream 31 airplane that is basically a drone. It's pilotless and apparently controlled from the ground. But the thing that about this article that I really kind of got my hair to stand on the back of my neck was this guy that they're interviewing. Sadly, he also affirmed that there aren't any plans to ship actual humans up in the air without a pilot on board. Sadly, come on, dude, that's just not safe. I'm sorry. I still say that it's going to be a long, long, long time before we see airplanes up there carrying passengers without pilots on board. And when that day comes, I am definitely not getting on the airplane or having anybody in my family or anybody I like or love to get on board. So thanks, Chess, for sending that in. And on a related note, my friend Kevin St. John sent me this article. MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, creates intelligent car co-pilot that only interferes if you're about to crash. Mechanical engineers and roboticists working at MIT have developed an intelligent automobile co-pilot that sits in the background and only interferes if you're about to have an accident. If you fall asleep, for example, the co-pilot activates and keeps you on the road until you wake up again. Boy, I wonder if we can do something like that in the airlines. No, I'm just kidding. Like other autonomous and semi-autonomous solutions, the MIT co-pilot uses an onboard camera and laser rangefinder to identify obstacles. These obstacles are then combined with various data points, such as the driver's performance, the car's speed, stability, physical characteristics, to create constraints. The co-pilot stays completely silent unless you come close to breaking one of these constraints, which might be as simple as a car in front braking quickly or as complex as taking a corner too quickly. When this happens, a ton of robotics under the hood take over, only passing back control to the driver when the car is safe. So the thing that I wanted to point out in this article that I thought was interesting is this paragraph. There is also the de-skilling issue, de-skilling issue, where eventually no one knows how to drive a car or fly a plane. This isn't so bad if every car on the road is autonomous and if steering wheels are removed altogether, but the in-between period could be tricky. To this end, the MIT team admits that their co-pilot needs to be tweaked to deliver significant negative feedback so that drivers, especially learners, don't get too big for their britches. And, of course, the very end of this article says, a completely autonomous road system with car-to-car communications would improve safety as well and reduce fuel consumption and increase the total capacity of roads, but at the expense of losing our ability to drive. And the reason why that's significant is that the same thing we're seeing in the flying world is that they want to automate our flights more and more and more, and at what expense? De-skilling. More and more pilots are forgetting how to fly. So thank you, Kevin St. John, for sending me that article. Okay, I'm back after a very nice dinner at the garage bar, and I forgot the formal name of the restaurant, but just a few blocks away from the hotel here in Miami, and it was really good, and had a couple pints of Bell's Two Hearted Ale, an IPA, which is just excellent if you ever have the chance to try it. Anyway, I'm not sure exactly where I was when I left the hotel room here, but I think I was about to play this voicemail from PJ in Houston.
Hey, Captain Jeff, it's your buddy PJ in Houston, Texas again. Hey, I wanted to give some feedback about the 737 overrun at Chicago Midway store you're talking about. I do have a slight theory as to why it might have taken them so long to deploy the thrust reversers. And granted, I'm not an actual 737 pilot. I do have a little bit of time in 737 sim at the major airlines training base here. But my understanding is that the 737 and most other Boeing aircraft, there's an interlock between the spoilers and the thrust reversers. So you actually cannot deploy the thrust reversers unless the spoilers are extended. So it could very well be that they forgot to arm the spoilers, and it took them a while to realize that, and then when they finally realized the spoilers weren't up, manually extended them and then deployed the thrust reversers, because I don't think you can put little levers up to deploy the thrust reversers unless those spoilers are extended. Anyway, I could be wrong on this. Hopefully an actual 737 pilot will confirm or debunk this theory of mine, but that's the best thing I can come up with. Anyway, enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, PJ. I think you're wrong. I talked to a couple 737 pilots regarding that, and they said there was no interlock, that you could definitely put the reverse out without having the spoilers deployed. And before I talked about that, I should have read the NTSB final report, but I have it in front of me right now. And it said that the flight crews delayed deployment of the speed brakes and thrust reversers, resulting in insufficient runway remaining to bring the airplane to a stop, is what contributed to this incident. Contributing to the delay in deployment of these stopping devices was the flight crew's inadequate monitoring of the airplane's configuration after touchdown, likely as a result of being distracted by a perceived lack of wheel braking effectiveness. Contributing to this incident was the flight crew's omission of the before landing checklist, which includes an item to verify speed brake arming before touchdown as a result of workload and operational distractions during the approach phase of flight. Okay, so to set the scenario here, there were a bunch of holding delays in the Chicago area due to weather and traffic congestion. ATC subsequently advised that they could accept an RNP Y 13 center approach to runway 13 center. The crew, however, mistakenly selected and briefed a different procedure, the RNAV GPS Z approach to runway 13 center. While in the hold, the crew assessed the landing distance available and correctly assessed the runway was sufficiently long for landing. When the aircraft was released from the holding pattern and received approach instructions, The crew was confused and discussed the instructions amongst them, the confusion most likely resulting from selecting the incorrect approach procedure. The crew finally identified the mistake, found the correct approach chart, reprogrammed the FMS to the correct RNP, RNP approach procedure, and amended some of the crossing altitudes in order to follow ATC instructions. The NTSB commented that this added workload to the crew. After they selected flaps 15, the preceding aircraft arriving reported fair braking action on the runway. The crew heard that report and reassessed the landing distance required, and correctly found that the landing distance available was still sufficient. The crew adjusted the auto brakes accordingly. When the crew intended to set flaps to 25 degrees, the airspeed was too high, requiring the airspeed to decay further before flaps could be set to 25 degrees, resulting in another distraction due to the flap overspeed. A rain shower passed over the aerodrome, needing further assessment, and the minimum descent altitude was still incorrectly set and needed to be adjusted. The flap overspeed occurred at the time that the crew would normally have processed the before landing checklist, which included the speed brakes armed task. The NTSB commented that the before landing checklist was not heard on the cockpit voice recorder and no mention of the speed brakes. The flight data recorder indicated the speed brakes remained unarmed. Shortly after setting the flaps to 25, the crew selected the flaps to 30 and then to 40 degrees for the final flap landing setting. The aircraft touched down within 500 feet past the runway threshold at 136 knots indicated. With 5,600 feet of runway remaining, the captain perceived lack of deceleration, assuming lack of brake effectiveness, and applied full manual braking. Speed brakes did not deploy upon touchdown because they had not armed them. The thrust reversers were not deployed. About 16 seconds after touchdown, the thrust reversers were deployed, which also deployed the speed brakes per system design. At that point, 1,500 feet of runway was remaining. When the aircraft came close to the end of the pavement, the captain attempted to steer the aircraft onto the last taxiway to the left, but was unable. The aircraft exited the runway at 30 knots above. Both engines at or near maximum reverse thrust, spoilers deployed, and brake pressure at 3,000 psi. The aircraft rolled onto the grass and came to a stop 180 feet off the paved surface and north of the runway's EMAS, which is Engineered Materials Arrestor System, or arresting system. The crew subsequently ascertained there was no fire, advised tower they were in the grass, and announced that passengers should remain in their seats. The passengers subsequently disembarked via mobile stairs. Okay, so basically a lot of distractions. They forgot to arm the spoilers, and the reason why it took so long for them to deploy the thrust reversers was that there was this many, many seconds of confusion as to why the airplane was not decelerating, even though they were applying maximum braking. If you don't have the spoilers out, the wheels are basically going to be hydroplaning. And then finally, it dawned on them that they should deploy the thrust reversers. So, in answer again to your question, PJ, or your assertion that there must be some kind of an interlock there, no. I've confirmed with folks that fly the airplane that that's not the case. And just to touch upon the EMAS system, the Engineered Materials Arresting System, that's a bed of engineered materials built at the end of a runway. Engineered materials are defined by the FAA as high energy absorbing materials of selected strength, which will reliably and predictably crush under the weight of an aircraft. And so basically, once the airplane gets into the system, it just basically collapses and the landing gear sinks into it. And it is very effective at stopping an airplane. And multiple patents, let's see. To date, EMAS has a 100% success rate. Every passenger on an aircraft that has entered an EMAS has walked away, and every aircraft has flown away, I guess, after they pulled it out. So thanks for your feedback, PJ. Keep it coming, man. Appreciate it. Okay, Steve, let's see, how are we doing here? 125, another long podcast. Steve Perry writes, Captain Jeff, in a recent podcast you mentioned that that Acme's DC-9 fleet does not have any RNAV capabilities. Was that an exaggeration? No, that's not an exaggeration. The idea of pilots tuning and twisting with one hand and working the E-6B at 400-plus knots with the other under the same union contract as someone on a near fully automated Airbus seems far-fetched. Is it really so? And wouldn't the fuel savings of random routes as opposed to airway routes pay for the avionics upgrades quickly in a Diesel 9? Steve Perry. Okay, let me answer several questions here, Steve. I know it's hard to understand, especially in this day and time, that we still have airliners out there flying without RNAV. And wow, it really works. I mean, I flew a 727 for 10 years, and that did not have any RNAV capability. And honestly, the airplanes that have RNAV capability, they're not flying random routes right now. They were flying airways. It's just that the RNAV system makes it easier and more accurate to fly these airways in our system. And in the 727, when we were flying long distances, especially in the middle of the night, where we didn't really need to follow the airways, we just received radar vectors, and it worked great. Every time you switched over to a new center frequency, they told you to fly another 5 degrees to the right or left or whatever, and you were flying the same great circle route that all the RNAV-equipped airplanes were flying. Regards the comment about fuel savings, it's really not a big difference. And no, it does not pay for the avionics upgrades. Now, you have to remember that Acme is probably going to be, you know, getting rid of these airplanes in the near future. So it really doesn't make sense to upgrade them to RNAV capability. But you know what? Again, you don't need to. They work just fine in our present airspace system. And the point about tuning and twisting with one hand and working the E6B, I have not seen an E6B in a long, long time. No, we don't use E6Bs up there. I can actually argue that flying the airways using ground-based navigational aids actually keeps you in the game a little bit more than it does with the system as I have in my airplane, where basically if you've programmed it correctly, it's going to fly that route with very high accuracy. And it's very easy to get complacent and assume that it's going to fly the routing that you told it to fly. Whereas the airplanes that have the systems where you are basically responsible for the navigation, you are paying close attention to the outbound and inbound courses, the winds. It really keeps you in a much higher level of engagement with what the airplane is doing. So I would argue that it's almost safer that way. I'm an old head, so what can I say? I like the old air. And we flew a fleet of 737-200s that didn't have any RNAV capabilities. The 727 did not have RNAV capabilities. And our present-day DC-9s do not. And they work just fine. So as far as the inequity of folks flying airplanes that don't have all the fancy magic stuff on it, compared to the people under the same union contract that fly the fully automated stuff. Well, that's one of those things in our industry that is a little unfair. The people out there in general, the people out there that are doing the hardest work, that are working the longest hours, the hardest working conditions, the most legs per day are the ones that are making the least amount of money. All those pilots working for all the regional airlines, they're flying much, much more than we are in mainline, and they are not making as much money as we are. And at the mainline level, the people at the senior end of the seniority list are flying the LA to Sydney trips. They're flying maybe 9 or 10 days a month and making a lot more money than I am. And I'm flying on average 16 to 20 days a month, sometimes more, and making a lot less. That's just the way the system works in the airlines, for good or for bad. So, yes, Steve, it's true. Thanks for your feedback. Appreciate it. Let's see here. Do I have time? I'm already in an hour and a half. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to save feedback from fellow Auburn alumni Jason Redd. We're going to play that on our next show. Before I go, I'd like to read this from Tyler McBee. You may remember him. He is an up-and-coming professional pilot. He, I don't remember exactly where he is. He's either in Alaska or maybe he's in Texas somewhere. Sorry, Tyler, I don't remember. But he has a blog called Positive Rate Gear Up, which is an awesome name for a blog. And he sent me this message via Facebook. Good evening, Captain Jeff. If you don't remember me, I'm the author of the blog Positive Rate Gear Up. I've recently founded and launched my own photography business. It's a branch of my blog called Positive Rate Photography. I opened it up in March of this year, and I have over 25 great pictures to choose from at what I think is a really great price, $10 or less. Anyways, I have not had any purchases, and the price of running the site and everything is much for not making any profit. I understand. I would really appreciate it if you would mention my photography business / hobby on your podcast. The website is www.positiveratephotography.webs.com. Thank you so much, and God bless. Again, that's positiveratephotography.webs.com. Check out Tyler's place. I did myself and some great photos there. So if you want to be the happy, proud owner of one of Tyler McBee's pieces of photographic art, head over to his website. And as always, Tyler, thanks for listening. Also, last podcast I mentioned that it'd really be helpful if you went over to iTunes and left me a review. And I'd like to thank Christopher Van Veen, Finn and Andy, Rob Touchtone, and more for heeding my call to leave me some feedback. I appreciate it, guys. And if you haven't done so yet, please, if you have a chance, I know you're busy, you lead busy lives, but head over to my iTunes page. I'll have a link in the show notes. And leave me a review, because I want as many people as possible to learn about this podcast and become part of our community so that they can become part of the show as well. So, again, thanks, guys. And finally, it's time to end the show. And you too can send feedback and be part of our show by, and I don't know why I keep saying our, but you know, it is our, it's you, it's me, it's all of us together exploring this wonderful world of aviation. Send me feedback at feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Or you can call up the Google Voice number 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. I'm Captain Jeff on Facebook, CaptJeff. On Twitter, I'm Jeff Nielsen and Airline Pilot Guy. And, of course, my website, airlinepilotguy.com. Also, you can now hear Airline Pilot Guy while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio, on-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode's always available for you. No syncing needed and no memory or storage wasted. Available on your iPhone, iPad, Android phones, and beyond. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com. Or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio. The smart way to listen to radio. And until we meet again, remember, try to stay in the middle of the air. Do not go near the edges of it. The edges of the air can be recognized by the appearance of ground, buildings, sea, trees, and interstellar space. It is much more difficult to fly there. And until next time, have a great week. Wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.